Welcome back to Radio EcoShock 2009. I'm Alex Smith.
Down here on the corner of ruin and grace, I'm growing weary of the human race. Hold my lamp up in everyone's face, looking for an honest man. Everyone tied to the turning wheel, everyone hiding from the things they feel. The truth's so hard, it just don't seem real. The shadow across this land.
Then you have skyrocketing prices, panic buying, and hoarding. When that happens, it doesn't matter how much oil is in the ground or if a new refinery was built somewhere. What happens is the people can't drive to their jobs. Businesses and factories and institutions can't get deliveries, and you have people unable to get the food they want, and supermarkets will be stripped in 3 to 5 days. It's going to be like a national Katrina.
Well, I'll be burning in the same big sun when the great correction.
A lot of people are finding out they're bankrupt or worried it could happen to them. The big banks are really insolvent and the government is really broke. All of them just knew the economy would keep on growing forever. And they could have found out otherwise from this week's Radio EcoShock guest, Jan Lundberg. Jan grew up in a family famous for tracking the oil and gas industry with the Lundberg Letter. He left that in 1986 and then discovered peak oil and the environment a couple of years later. Jan Lundberg has become a well-known writer and energy activist in California. His website, culturechange.org, has attracted a movement of like-minded thinkers who want to bail out this sinking good ship Earth. Jan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure.
So let's get to these real issues, Jan. You say you discovered peak oil in 1988. When did you start to realize that climate change was another flaw in the fossil fuel civilization?
Well, it was that same year. There were some terrible heat waves back east, and as I was moving my career into environmental protection, away from serving the oil industry and government in 1988, I happened to have dinner in D.C. on a hot summer night with somebody with Environmental Defense Fund, and he told me that this heat wave actually might reflect the global warming which had indeed begun. I said, no, come on, you're kidding. He said, no, it's for real. So that was when, and that was the year that Al Gore, you know, held the hearings where James Hansen of NASA talked about it. So that was everybody's wake-up call. And that was mine, too.
Well, it's such an ironic universe, these fossil fuels, that they've almost led us into a self-made technical evolution, and then they turn out to be lethal to the planet's ecosphere. But there's still divided camps, I find, on the web and in speaking to people between those who are sort of really working on peak oil and those who are working on the climate. And I'm wondering how we get these folks to understand that they're both part of the same big problem.
Well, they certainly are. I found that some peak oil activists are not really environmental activists, so they're kind of lamenting the loss of all this extensive energy that people have been using like there's no tomorrow. And so they're upset about losing consumer conveniences. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize, but that's just one of the reasons that can account for someone really not placing climate change as high up in the level of concern. To me, in the last several years, I've noticed that climate change and petrol collapse, or the effects of peak oil, have been in some kind of a race. And it used to be that several years ago, people thought, well, climate change is going to come sometime in the 21st century. We're going to be suffering the effects. And every year that went by, things seemed to accelerate. And meanwhile, the collapse from our petroleum dependence, from the overbuilt economy and all the financial funny money, this seems to have gotten a reprieve here and there. They could extend the whole growth machine with the WTO and wars, and that has managed to put things off. So collapse of the economy hasn't quite hit as fast as some of us thought, but we see climate collapse accelerating. It is, of course, quite intricately related.
Yeah, well, I'd like to get some your take on some recent news. On August 20th, during the sleepy summer holidays, the White House approved a pipeline to carry dirty tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to the American refineries. And this line's from the Enbridge Company, and it's called the Alberta Clipper. Well, the deal was done by executive order, not through Congress or the usual branches, allegedly as a national interest determination. Now, that means a lot more greenhouse gases from the tar sands, and they're possibly the most energy-hungry oil sources on Earth, just to fill American gas tanks. What happened to the green, climate-aware Obama White House?
Well, I don't know if that's really the right question. Those of us who were looking at the reality of the role of government and serving its corporate constituency, we knew that the Obama regime was not going to be all that green. I think it's important for people to see energy reality than to get their hopes up in, you know, reforming the political system. And about the tar sands, this is something that is never going to really replace much of the conventional oil, which is dwindling fast.
But Obama says, well, he's going to leave emissions control to Canada. Well, the atmosphere doesn't care who's to blame or if you slough it off onto another country or blame China. I just don't see this working at all.
Exactly. And as long as the present economy and powers that be are in place and petroleum can be extracted and refined and distributed in the quantities that, you know, the world economy is demanding, really nothing is going to change. So it is going to be more of a collapse, a situation for things to really change politically as well and in terms of how we use energy. And this could benefit the planet, except when things are really getting out of control and there might be some more damage to the environment, or if we fail to babysit the nukes, then you can't say that collapse is just this wonderful favor to the environment.
The only thing that would really stir Americans and Canadians into action are the prices at the pump, that as long as you can do it, whether it's from the tar sands or any overseas war you need to make, as long as those prices at the pump are there and we find the gas we want, well, then we'll just go on living the way we've been going. Is that the story?
Well, of course, the idea is, Barack Obama's agenda as well. Keep it going. Just keep the status quo going, and don't panic. Keep buying. Keep the corporate profits up. Our way of life is wonderful and privileged, and we have to, you know, keep enjoying it and pay all the costs, even if it's others having to shoulder that burden.
Well, I noticed, too, on your website that you'd highlighted an article about the ocean temperatures being higher. I think it was in July than ever recorded. It's foolish to try and forecast the future, but what is your best guess about where this climate is headed?
Well, it's quite a saddening and frightening prospect to sense things getting out of control. We grew up with the comforting notion of the sun coming up and the weather being something we can deal with. And we also had the food and water that we needed. And now when you think of crops failing or disasters caused by climate disruption, then all bets are off. So the world as we know it is coming to an end. And we're going to have to, if we cannot just terminate greenhouse gas emissions as they should be right now, then we have to accept the fact that things are just going to get worse and worse. And there's a lead time built in. We're not going to be able to just stop it. There were some campaigns centered around the idea of stopping global warming. This is impossible. It's in the pipeline, and there are going to be positive feedbacks that are already taking place, like the melting of methane crystals under the sea. So it's a scary situation. I suppose that there could be a silver lining in the sense that there could be a sudden realignment or adjustment that nature causes us to adapt to. And we'll have to be kinder to the Earth, probably because we'll no longer have the capability of destroying what's left of the climate. But it probably will be economic collapse and the lack of fossil energy to continue that that'll really get us to change.
Well, I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Jan Lundberg, a former oil and gas insider, now an agent for a new energy economy and the social change that requires. Did I describe you correctly there?
Well, I have not really subscribed to the idea of a new energy economy. I believe that there will be economies plural. I believe that with petrol collapse and such climate disruption, the surviving pockets of humanity are going to be quite sovereign and separated by natural boundaries. And, you know, if we stop and think about it, why should we be getting food and such from many, many thousands of miles away, foods out of season? And what do we really need from the other side of this continent? Why should we be taking orders or following an agenda that is set on the East Coast if we're living on the West Coast? So there are going to be changes in that regard. And this has to do with energy very much in the sense that what has been built is a very centralized, inefficient system. So when it's decentralized and local-based, it will be the particular forms of energy that are available for an ecosystem. And if we're not producing energy that we don't need for a huge population of consumers with redundant appliances and their own cars and computers and so forth, then it's going to be not really an energy economy, but an economy integrated with the ecosystem. And then we'll just be using energy as a matter of course, like people did for thousands of years, where energy was built into the food, into the timber they used, and so forth.
So you're talking about indigenous people and their energy balance. I wonder, can we really learn from that? And if so, what could we learn from that?
Well, we're kind of working on that at Culture Change. I have a colleague named Rebecca Lerner who has been posting articles on primitive skills and sustainable living through indigenous life ways. And when we stop and think about it, native peoples are really the only model of sustainability that we have. And how much have we lost from that wisdom? We're not even retaining our own culture's wisdom when grandparents pass on and they haven't been able to teach their children and grandchildren, and instead they're farmed out to nursing homes and they're not raising the young generations, then we really don't know how to manage in a world without things delivered to us with fossil fuels. So there are great changes ahead, and we need to look at everything we know that we've developed that will fit into the future sustainable culture and go back to look at how the indigenous traditional ways provided all needs for millennia.
We have to think about future generations, obviously, and we don't do that. We don't think in the business model beyond the next quarter or the next coming bonus for the big executives, because we know that there are places in North America and around the world that are just draining down their water tables, and when they're gone, they're gone, their fossil water supplies. Or just think of the way we're using oil. We presume, well, we'll just burn it all until it's gone. I'm thinking, well, maybe three generations from now, they'd like to have a little bit left to run something really important, like an ambulance service or something, but we don't plan for that.
That's true. And if we could be rational as a people, there would be some really intelligent planning. But since that's not being done, and since we don't see a social movement to turn things around or to take over and offer new leadership, then we have to anticipate collapse, and we have to put into place today the models and tools of sustainability. And that's a wonderful thing going on here and there. There's permaculture, there's eco-villages. We're trying to start the sail transport network. We've operated pedal power produce. And so these kinds of systems and ways of thinking that also bring people together, which is so essential for people to have that community and closeness that they've lost in the consumer economy. All these things are going to help us when they're needed most urgently, when the trucks stop pulling into the supermarkets.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that day myself. I mean, we depend totally on fossil fuels for a lot more than cars. It's plastics and it's, you know, pesticides, fertilizers, electricity. Can we talk a little bit about the impact of declining fossil fuels on our food supply?
Well, petroleum is the way we grow and process and distribute and cook and package our food. And it is such a ridiculous dependency for the vulnerability and the unsustainability that this presents, that you'd think there'd be much greater concern and some planning and a move to get away from that dangerous situation. But the most we're able to see is with the recession, gardening is up 20%. And some people have not bought new cars. They're fixing existing cars, which I totally approve of. I mean, I've been car-free for 2 decades. But if you're going to buy a car, let's buy a used car. Let's not hand the corporations money for new products. So when people are not even using cars and they're using bikes and hooking up bike carts, and they do some depaving and take some space back from the car, we're creating local food supply. People are getting together and providing for themselves instead of wondering about how they can get some more cash to give it to strangers for products produced by people far away who are unknown to them. So we see some positive changes, but very few people are actually involved in trying to prepare for the future. People are generally forced by circumstances to change, and it could be too late for massive famine if people are continuing to assume there will be unlimited energy for food production and distribution.
Yeah, well, we've been fed so well for our whole generation, and you know, so much of the population is overweight or obese. And I think September 11th attacks, they showed, among other things, that people far away may not quietly starve to death while we gorge ourselves. With global TV illuminating the stage, is it possible that North Americans will begin to know what hunger really means?
Only when they feel it themselves, and then they're going to be very surprised and angry and will be quite violent about it, perhaps. It's going to be like a national Katrina. In this country, people are less prepared for this kind of disruption because we're using the most petroleum per capita, I think. I would say that the reason things are so urgent with petroleum, and I'll put on my oil industry hat here, the way that depletion works and oil supply disruption works, it's really the oil industry market, the market that determines how much supply is in the system that matters much more than reserves. We've heard about peak oil, and there's a theoretical bell curve that goes with it. And it is assumed by many, including peak oil authorities, that there will be a kind of a smooth downslide, diminishing of oil extraction, which would then be refined and distributed. However, the oil industry is not set up for shrinking, and certain aspects of it, such as refining and producing from wells, don't lend themselves to a ratcheting down whereby you'd have an oil industry at 60% and then 40% and then 20% of what it is today. So if you look at what is available in terms of petroleum products urgently needed and furiously distributed around the world today, when that is tripped up by a supply shortage to the tune of 9 or 10% or more, then you have skyrocketing prices, panic buying, and hoarding. When that happens, it doesn't matter how much oil is in the ground or if a new refinery was built somewhere. What happens is the people can't drive to their jobs. Businesses and factories and institutions can't get deliveries. And you have people unable to get the food they want. And supermarkets will be stripped in 3 to 5 days. So it really is a matter of great sudden and chaotic adjustment to something that really isn't there yet. There is no energy substitute waiting in the wings that can be scaled up to substitute for petroleum. And the ones we hear about are really for electricity and not liquid fuels anyway. So we have quite a dangerous situation right around the corner, which really doesn't have a lot to do with whether tar sands can be built up much more than 2 million barrels a day refined or not, or if more solar panels can be put up or more wind turbines. So if we've greatly exceeded our ecological carrying capacity through all this very cheap energy, but it's gone. The remaining energy doesn't have the net energy characteristic, the high yield that it had in former times in recent decades.
So we could have a breakdown in the distribution system that would radiate outward to create an economic crisis, which then just can't cope with it at all.
We will have this, and it will be very rapid, and we're not prepared.
Wow. So this, I guess, is where the localization movement comes in, is almost like a lifeboat-type philosophy of, well, let's have some areas where people will be able to cope. Is that the idea?
Absolutely, and that's what the back-to-the-land hippies figured out back in the late 60s. And it's never really gone away. It's had different names, and there have been communes. There have been just folks trying to maximize their own food growing, and we were promoting this with the Auto Free Times magazine when we were managing the Alliance for a Paving Moratorium. And it's great that knowledge of peak oil and localization have become much more appreciated.
It must make you tear your hair out to see the Obama administration and governments around the world, they're doing the same thing here in Canada, announcing multi-billion dollar bridges and nine-lane highways and lots more paving just at the time when that's obviously the wrong way to go.
Well, it is, and there's a lot of jive associated with it, such as jobs. Well, if you want jobs, you fix the existing roads that would employ 10 times as many people. So it's really about the same old, you know, the old boy network and speculators, high profits, expansion, urban sprawl, and they've just put a green face on it by saying, well, there will be a few more crumbs for bicycling and greener this and that, and maybe traffic will be functioning smoother if we pave everything over. So this is something people should not buy, but it's been going on for many decades, and it's not going to stop until there's either complete financial collapse or the kind of interruption in oil supplies that will bring about the final and largest aspects of petrol collapse, which I believe has already begun.
It could be eerie to see these gigantic roadways with people who can't afford the gas to drive around on them. They'll be rather emptied out.
Well, we bicycle activists have been saying for a long time that there's going to be a lot of big bike paths out there with plenty of room.
Well, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we're talking with Jan Lundberg, a former oil and gas insider, now proposing radical cultural changes. In fact, you call your website culturechange.org. Why do you do that?
Well, culture change seemed to be the key to what was puzzling us in the late 90s, We noticed the best farmland being paved over. And we noticed on the family and individual level, people were so separated and stealing each other's inheritances and family. And all of this pointed to a value system that was way out of whack. So a change in culture has been happening. It needs to accelerate in a good way. And so that's what we chose instead of to focus on energy or transportation.
I think you've got close to the core of the issue, in my opinion, because we have the facts now about peak oil and about climate change, and yet we're stuck in a rut, to use the old car culture language. We can't seem to change the way we think. That seems to be the big problem, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and we can only think in terms of what's around us and what we've been taught. I had a very strange upbringing. I was brought up on an organic ranch and sailed from California to Greece. And my father actually was doing something you're doing now, a broadcast journalist. And he had the first talk show on in television history in Los Angeles in the 1950s, a muckraking thing. So, yes, you know, someone like me has looked at the problems around us and the possibilities for a better way of living, and I've been happy to try to share that. Some people just go for it, even though they've had a very traditional, conventional upbringing, and they just go right for the changes. So it's sort of an inclination some of us have, or just the good fortune some of us have had to think differently. But that is really what's required, and questioning what we've been taught and trying to unlearn that. And then taking action. That's the other big factor here that is crucial.
Well, just for the sake of argument, some of the solutions you advocate sound like going back to pre-oil technologies and ways of life. And other people have argued that technology may not be reversible, that we're almost, you know, part machine ourselves now. So 6 or 7 billion people can't really go back to the land. How do you answer that criticism?
Well, it's absolutely true that we've outstripped carrying capacity to all go back to the land. So ultimately, when there will be a much smaller population size to you know, use sustainably what's available, we'll be closer to nature. Otherwise, we won't make it as a species, and we'll continue to drag others down towards extinction very rapidly. But when it comes to how technological we are and whether that can be turned around or not, I think people are confusing, you know, technology with energy and vice versa. So when we have had cheap energy, such as 100 barrels per 100 barrels of oil per one barrel that was input for the extraction, when that kind of net energy was possible, and it's not happening anymore, amazing things were done, and the chemistry of what can be done with petroleum has really been phenomenal and mind-blowing, but it has served to poison the earth and our bodies, such as what plastics do, and they're filling up the ocean, something terrible right now as we speak. It is important that we question the notions of progress and growth, which this civilization has depended on, but at some point it's the end of the road, and we have to take a much narrower path of nature.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
We're talking with Jan Lundberg, and another argument I hear, Jan, is that the current economic crisis that we're seeing in the Western world may actually be a rebalancing. We've taken for granted that most of the world's resources come to America or Europe for consumers. I can't believe we actually bought that as a model. But now some of that is going to Asia, at least, where people in India and China get some electricity, some roads, some televisions, and maybe some more consumer goods. Is there a kind of justice as Americans use less and others get more?
Well, you could look at it that way. You could also see a poetic justice in millions of basically native peoples coming from south of the United States border to repopulate what's known as the Indian, or in your country, the First Nation populations. But when it comes to other industrializing countries using more fossil fuels and stripping their topsoil and water supplies, this is simply an unfortunate development which will not serve them in the long run, and we all suffer the climate effects of those activities. And it's also true that in the United States we lose our skills and our resources and our means of managing our lives. When we become a third world nation of service employees and we are obtaining products from far away, from people we don't know, shipped via petroleum, this is something that reflects a very quick change in our people. It's a generation of unskilled, unprepared consumers. And so when other countries are supplying the products and they themselves are enjoying some of these products for the class of people that can afford them, then this is just part of the whole global change that has to do with manipulating nature and stumbling upon this bounty known as petroleum. But it's coming to an end. Peak does not mean the second half of petroleum consumption is unfolding. No, it is a completely unknown world we're stepping into, and it can be very rapidly changing.
That's unbelievable. You know, car sales in China were higher than in the U.S. last year, and they're building more roadways, and I understand that Buicks are really popular there, nice big cars. It seems like oil is almost a drug that gets people high and then it kills them. It's like a disease that's spreading out over the world, I feel.
Well, sure, and it is an addiction of some kind. It's important not to focus just on petroleum because a lot of people imagine, well, there's a clean substitute. We'll be able to continue our lives as very sophisticated scientific people enjoying modern convenience and progress. This is something that is actually a dangerous and wrong-headed view. Because there is no real substitute for petroleum with all its flexibility and versatility. And when people are depending on petroleum for their transportation and agriculture and the plastics, this is something that is crucial to recognize and to try to plan around, but to try to extend it is folly and is a big disservice to everyone. So we have to boycott and walk away from petroleum as much as possible, and that, I think, is probably the best social movement, a strategy for rapid change, and to kick the system where it hurts and begin to use our own resources and capabilities in our own smaller communities and cheat the corporations out of being enriched.
Well, according to the latest news, the people who own the big corporations have been cheating the taxpayers, heading off to Switzerland and other places. But, you know, anybody who looks through the web or reads the papers, the headlines keep coming along, unheard of events, things that are so jaw-dropping, I could go away for 2 hours and think about that one thing, but there's 20 of them. And at the same time, I can't escape this feeling of stagnation. We aren't changing much. The government can't do much, as Katrina showed us. And the same crooks run the banks and the stock market. It feels like suspended animation, but a big storm is raging outside a solid plate glass window, and it feels so ominous to me, and I know a lot of people are worried deep down. Are you sensing that?
Well, yes, there's a bit more of that, but being basically an optimist, I think that it's liberating to view things in a stark fashion for the first time. If people can picture modern humanity as mostly slaves, with another good many of us living off the sweat of others, then it puts a different light on what's going on, instead of here's a news item on some scientific breakthrough. The corporate media serve to distract us. So if we're able to change our lives and keep moving in a direction of liberating ourselves from the thuggery of those in charge, who are dressed well and speak so well, it's still oppression and exploitation for people and nature. And to reject that and to work with those who see a better way is quite pleasurable.
You've talked about several good ideas that could give us hope. Can you expand on that a little bit? What are some of the ideas that are happening on the ground in the real world that you know about?
Well, as I mentioned, when we can link people together with a local food supply, and people are cooperating and bartering and not commuting off into the distance, wrecking their health and the commute, and earning dollars to trade for things that should be free in nature anyway, or produced in their community, these are trends that actually are rather hopeful. And it's all inevitable. You can lament the loss of this technological boom and all the convenience. You can say, well, I need my car. You can say, well, maybe some more oil will be discovered. But all of this is quite inevitable in the direction of a real community culture. And so you see things happening like you've heard of the 100-mile diet. Well, here in Portland, some people are practicing the 5-mile diet. There are some community gardens in former front lawns. We're trying to hook up with bike carts and sailboats, a system that will allow people to have some food security. Now, we have around, you said I was in California. I was until several months ago. I'm in Portland, Oregon nowadays. And we did demonstrate that a lot of food can be bike carted, and we got some of it delivered with sailboat as well. There is so much to integrate, so many pieces of the puzzle that are good developments and hopeful, that it will create a food security system where distribution is by appropriate technology. And there's an ethic here to really eat local. It is such a point of pride. The average restaurant is featuring local vegetables and fruits and meats whenever possible. It's just sort of a bubble in the United States.
Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction, but you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Yes, and it's really our true nature. We lived in a tribal communal fashion for, you can trace us back to 200,000 years roughly. And this is what we knew. We didn't know the corporate state or environmental devastation except by natural forces. And so if we have to go back, as someone might call it, at least what was known in the past, was the closeness of the village community, people working for the group, and having the extended family, which, if we look around in North America, it's supposedly some great mark of independence and accomplishment for us to be so isolated and for families just to see each other on holidays.
Well, I know that's changing, and I'm working on my own family relations, and I think we're seeing people moving back in with the parents due to the economic situation or, you know, for a variety of reasons. As I say, I think there are unstoppable changes for the better coming as well. We're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm Alex Smith. You've been listening to Jan Lundberg on Radio EcoShock. I check Jan's website, culturechange.org, pretty well every day to get a sane alternative to that mainstream news. Thank you for joining us, Jan.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been great.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our opening music, When the Great Correction Comes, is from Eliza Gilkison. Well, you know, you've really inspired me here, Jan, because I had the feeling that there's nothing we can do to stop the decline and the destruction, but you've also brought up the point that there's nothing we can do to stop the healing and the rearrangement that humans will make.
Don't let me down when the great correction comes. And we're a home going to die. Yes, we're a home going to die.
Pick a date, any date. The race is on to nail down the big crisis, the day the oceans die and humans go extinct. John Doscher is just one example of this latest blood sport, but he's in the very best company. Doscher is an 82-year-old self-taught man who laid out his doom and gloom on August 9th at the 2009 New York Greenfest. That speech was broadcast across the country by the underground hit show Unwelcome Guest. Apparently, host Lynn Gary took some flack for Doscher's untrained claims, and especially for the old man's prediction that humans should go extinct in the year 2034. Or was it 2033? It makes a big difference. Guys like this give honest doomers like myself a bad name. I'm Alex Smith, host of another depressing syndicated program, Radio EcoShock. First of all, who is John Doscher? The man doesn't even have a web page, for heaven's sake. No email. Doesn't show up on Google. Can he be real at all? Once I get over my frustration at not being able to effortlessly peg this guy as a would-be prophet, I build myself up in froth of righteous green anger. What's an amateur doing, trying to sum up the world with far-out solutions like ending all commercial fishing? Or going all the way out there, like banning new babies around the world for 20 years to prevent that overpopulation thing? Then I recall my own amateur status. Aren't we all doing the same thing? Aren't we all trying, like a million computers, to figure out the big picture, to solve our suicidal urges as a species? I've seen photos of a building in Japan the size of 10 football fields. It's entirely filled with supercomputers, all calculating our climate future. But in the end, there's no group consciousness to interpret the results. We can work in teams, and scientists do, but finally, the conclusions form in just one mind at a time, yours and mine. Some people may be brighter than others, but there is no guarantee that the most honored scientist in the world will get it better than an 82-year-old in upstate New York. We don't know where or when some unannounced mind will crack the code, will discover another valuable grain of truth. So we all try, and we should.
Can't you hear the clock is ticking? We're slipping away, away.
I'm not going to analyze John Doscher's whole speech. Get it yourself at Unwelcome Guest, Program 476, Hour 1, at radioforall.net. Doscher made me mad. Then he made me think, and I thought about it for days, and that's the sign of good radio. When I looked around, there were a collection of top experts and government advisors saying some of the same things about our limited time left on this planet, at least as we've known it. I want to focus on just two main things that Doscher said that seem outrageous. For one thing, he says overfishing leaves uneaten algae. that bloom into dead zones, that emit hydrogen sulfide gas, that will kill off the plant and animal world. Crazy. Or is it? We'll investigate the oceans will kill us theory with Dr. Peter Ward and Dr. Boris Worm. Let's hear a bit from that John Doscher speech at the New York Green Fest.
Here's an example. In 2008, about April 23rd on WSKG-TV, there was a National Geographic special, Strange Doings on Planet Earth. European fishing fleets had destroyed the fishery off Southwest Africa. They left. The fish began to return, but too slowly. The plankton, which normally, most of them by far, have their life cycles on or near the surface, weren't eaten. They died, sank to the bottom in unaccustomed tonnages, and rotted, producing huge amounts of hydrogen sulfide and methane. These were locked into the ooze by pressure. But when a low-pressure weather system went overhead, they were released in New Jersey-sized explosions. The hydrogen sulfide killed all the fish. The methane went into the atmosphere, where it stays for about a decade. Methane, molecule for molecule, is 103 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. I have to change tenses now because that process is still going on. Indeed, there seems to be no way to stop it. Then, a few weeks later, there was a news item on NPR that there are presently 200 such zones around the world, and I wish that somebody would check that out. Can we live with extinctions, with mass extinction? Can we live on a planet whose temperature has been raised 25 degrees by huge releases of methane? No, we cannot. Such a release occurred 55 million years ago. It raised the Earth's temperature 25 degrees, extinguishing at least 95% of all species. Had there been humans, they would have been extinguished very quickly. Taking care of the ecology matters. If we don't figure out a way to stop that methane release process off Southwest Africa and all those other places, very soon, we're gone. Well, couldn't we wait it out in underground cities? The answer is that it took the Earth 10 million years to evolve a new biosphere that worked. Could those facilities last 10 million years?
Probably you heard a few alarm bells going off. First of all, did the Earth's climate go up 25 degrees 55 million years ago? Well, he's talking Fahrenheit, of course. Most scientists use Celsius, which would be a lot lower. Still, I'd have to do a lot of checking before I'd believe that figure. Now we consider that a rise of 6 degrees Celsius, mean global temperature, should be enough to kill off most life on Earth, except at the poles and deep under the sea. But there's a lot of assumptions in Doscher's claims that scientists wouldn't make. It's a little like the chain of custody argument in legal evidence. Things don't necessarily follow in the order he gives from that one example off the coast of Africa. Yes, deoxygenated dead zones are forming in many parts of the world. But are they all simply caused by a lack of fish to eat algae? What about the pesticides and fertilizer runoff pumping the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico? Scientists think that the changing sea currents may have altered the upwelling of nutrients off the west coast, making that dead zone off of Oregon. Overfishing may be helping kill off the seas, but other factors like ocean acidification are part of the picture too. And yet, the idea that hydrogen sulfide bubbling out of the ocean, causing mass extinction of land life, well, it's not as crackpot as you'd think. Here's a small clip from my own interview with Dr. Peter Ward, whose book Under a Green Sky proposes that as a lingering nemesis from ages past.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio.
And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell, and the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in ourselves that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, there's no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing, and the microbes have produced that produced this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Peter Ward has spent a lifetime trying to find the causes of five or six previous mass extinctions. His book, Under a Green Sky, explaining how the seas could kill off planetary life from one climate shift that stops the ocean currents, it didn't sell well, he told me. Where's the product spin-offs, the business plan? No money to be made knowing what the Grim Reaper looks like, especially when it turns out to be just toxic bacteria anyway. No movie rights either. Aliens or zombies sell much more popcorn. Let's move on to Doscher's claim that fish will be gone soon. His answer is to end commercial fishing all over the world. I presume he means by force, if necessary. I doubt even the U.S. Navy and Air Force could shoot down all those trawlers and those little fishing boats from who knows where, but maybe governments could hack up the docks or something. Over a billion people on Earth depend on fish as their major source of protein. Doscher says he once read a report from World Watch Institute saying all the fish will be dead by 2033. Sounds like a good date. I could be packed by then. But I wish I had the original report. There has been a better update on that prediction from a team of scientists representing some top ocean studies institutions. Their date for the end of commercial fishing, since there's nothing left, is 2048. Here's a quick slice from my Radio EcoShock report on dying fisheries from November 10th, 2006, still posted as a free download on my site, ecoshock.org.
The world is running out of seafood and running out soon. Exactly 42 years from now, in the year 2048, there will be nothing left to fish in oceans. That's the precise and dire conclusion of a major new study released today by the journal Science.
Clam bakes, crab cakes, and even fish sticks could one day be a thing of the past.
Oh my God! The fish are dying!
A new report says if current trends of overfishing and pollution continue, all seafood could be wiped out in 40 years, and not just ocean life. Ecologists are also worried about fish in lakes and rivers.
That's what kills me about mass media news. Horrors never before known can be reported in those news voices, followed immediately by the trivial, as though the disappearance of fish in the sea is just another story. Personally, I thought this woman's reaction was a little more realistic.
Oh my God! I can't believe it! I had no idea!
A homophobic preacher admits hiring a gay prostitute? Now that is interesting. Everyone is clicking to find out more. The end of seafood? Not so much. These days, notice I did not say in these end times, environmental news requires a horror soundtrack with cues for when we should cry out or scream. I suppose that's part of the mission of Radio EcoShock. In the May 2003 issue of the journal Nature, two scientists from Canada's Maritime Provinces released their study, Rapid Worldwide Depletion of Predatory Fish Communities. Their research showed that 90% of all large fish, the upper tier predators, were already gone. Fish like tuna, marlin, swordfish, sharks, cod, and halibut. All right, in late October 2006, Dr. Worm was again the lead author in a major study by 14 scientists from Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, Panama, and Australia. Institutions like Stanford University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Stockholm University were participating. It is titled Impact of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services and published in the journal Science for November 3rd. The team analyzed mountains of data about fish catches from around the world, going back 50 years, and even cross-checked against historical records up to 1,000 years old. Dr. Worm couldn't believe the computer analysis, and so cross-checked the results by hand.
And I saw that the trend of collapse of seafood species projected into the future predicts that by the year 2050 there will be no more species left to fish. And I really recall the hair standing up in the back of my neck and a shiver down my spine as I watched over the students, and I thought, it's going to be in all of your lifetime, and in my lifetime too. I'm going to be old. But still, I will see this happen if nothing changes, if we don't change the way we're treating ocean ecosystems.
I get into it a lot more detail in that program, so go ahead and download it when you're ready. Maybe John Doscher isn't that far off after all. Toss in the Arctic Sea, summer ice melt, and a whole bunch of non-linear or positive feedback events. Maybe the fish will be gone by 2033. Here's Doscher's solution.
So here we go. One, close all marine fisheries. Restock them with fish using special ships that can transport them alive. Net excess plankton. Use them to generate methane to be immediately burned in combined cycle cogenerative power plants, which can be up to 94% efficient. And reduce carbon emissions tremendously for an interim period until that problem of the fisheries is solved and until a shift has been made to solar and wind.
Remember Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society? He's been calling on the world's navies to start enforcing fisheries laws, as well as protecting the last of the major big species like whales, dolphins, and sharks. Too bad nobody does it. Right now, there's a Japanese trawling fleet, or a Russian one, or somebody from Europe, wiping out another Polynesian island's food supply for a generation, or trawling a seamount to death. It's happening right now, and there's nobody doing a damn thing about it. Maybe the fish will survive if we go extinct first. John Doscher suggests that could come as early as 2033. There's a nice ring to that. Should we have some kind of televised memorial planned, like Michael Jackson's? With a million-year retrospective on the big-brained apes. Or maybe just a huge celebration. Peace at last. Let's party. Something bigger than the Olympics, anyway, as we go out. It sounds like crazy talk again, except the chief scientific advisor to the British government has just picked 2030 as a year of super crisis for the human race. Professor Sir John Beddington is the chief scientific advisor to Her Majesty's government, otherwise known as Britain. On March 19th, at an event called SDUK09, Beddington mused how converging crises will at least cripple humanity, if not kill us off, by 2030. He begins with the fact we're stacking 6 million more humans a month on this planet to hit 8 billion people by 2030. Meanwhile, as Beddington tells the BBC...
First of all, there's an increase in the demand for food. That's going to be up by about 50% by 2030. The increase in the demand for energy is going to be up by a similar amount. And the demand for fresh water, which is really very important, is going to be up by something like 30 or 40%. At the same time, there are real problems that we can't just ignore the issue of climate change. So increasing the supply of food, energy and water has got to be done at the same time without presenting problems for mitigating greenhouse gas emissions to address the climate change problem. And all that's happening in 21 years.
Beddington predicts collapsing governments, food riots, mass starvation, and unimaginable numbers of climate refugees swarming for cover. Of course, being a government man, he doesn't think that's the end. He's ruthlessly optimistic. We'll find a way to grow twice as much food with half the water as crops die in the heat. Like a Hollywood movie, we human heroes always win in the end. Not according to Royal Academy scientist James Lovelock. He's recently suggested no more than 8% of our current billions will survive past the year 2100. Climate disruption should provide the diseases, droughts, and floods to do in the rest. So there you go. The experts agree, and maybe John Doscher's right there. We're all going to die. We just don't know when. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Tune in at our website, ecoshock.org, and check out our list of stations broadcasting the show. It's got to be some of the most depressing stuff on radio, but we strive for the truth.
Our duty to the human race is clear.
Our music is two versions of We're All Going to Die, one by Johnny Kula and the A-Grades, and then the same title by Malcolm Middleton, his cheery Christmas tune. You'll get that at the end. Let's get a pool going. Send me your preferred date for human extinction and a link to the website or news article giving the gory details. Maybe we'll make a whole show out of that. Send your entry to radio@ecoshock.org. You could win $2 billion payable on our last day on Earth.
We're all gonna die, whatever's nothing, we'll all have to face us alone. There's a win, not an end. inside everybody. More thoughts like these can make you feel so alone. You're gonna die, you're gonna die, you're gonna die alone. You're gonna die, you're gonna die, you're gonna die.